The tally from Election Day 2019 in Texas. We'll try to read between the numbers to see what message Texas voters were sending. The results and a whole lot more today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Where do we stand with those new constitutional amendments in a major mayoral race in Houston? Yeah, we'll get caught up this hour. Plus, what a new survey reveals about Texas attitudes on immigration and climate change as we head toward that next election cycle. How to keep college students from leaving their Texas hometowns for good, plus a weekly PolitiFact check and a whole lot more. No matter where you are, the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this sixth day of November 2019. I'm David Brown, and we can't say it enough. We're so grateful you're spending a bit of your Texas time with us. And now, let's do the numbers. 10. The number of constitutional amendments on the ballot in yesterday's statewide election. 1. The number of amendments Texas voters rejected. 94. The percentage of Texas voters who said yes to allowing former caretakers of law enforcement animals to adopt those critters without a fee. Yes, that's now enshrined in our Texas Constitution. 88. The percentage of Texans voting to earmark sales tax on sporting goods to help stabilize state parks. But I guess here's the biggie. 76, the percentage of voters who said yes to a constitutional amendment making it harder for Texas to enact a personal income tax. For those who like to read between the numbers, there's probably a story or two here. And to help us tease it out, Renee Cross. She is the senior director of the Hobby School of Public Affairs at the University of Houston. Professor Cross, thanks for joining us on The Standard.
Good morning.
Busy night in the Houston area. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Let's take a look at how things broke down statewide, especially these constitutional amendments I was talking about. All of them passed except for Prop 1. What did that propose, and why do you think voters weren't buying it?
Well, Proposition 1 would allow municipal judges to hold more than one paid position at the same time. So they could preside over multiple municipalities, whether appointed or elected. That one did not pass, the only one of the 10 that didn't pass. It had a 66% no. I would guess that people just didn't quite understand the nuances of this because we already have in the Constitution exemptions for allowing people to hold more than one public office at the same time. This proposition would have just added municipal judges to it. So I think on the surface, it may have just looked like, well, you know, why should someone have two jobs and
right.
get paid twice on
right.
the state's dime?
Well, let's talk about something that clearly a lot of folks were paying attention to, and that's this issue of the imposition of a personal income tax. Now, this amendment will make it very hard for state lawmakers to do such a thing, but it doesn't seem like it's an actual ban per se. What does it do?
That's correct. It just makes it harder to try to enact a state income tax. Previously, we had to have a simple majority of both the House and the Senate mm-hmm. before it went to the voters. And now we have to have a two-thirds support from both the House and the Senate and a majority of the voters to enact a state income tax.
Well, certainly a race that caught a lot of people's attention, not just in Houston, but statewide. That's the mayoral race in Houston. What were the results?
Well, in Houston, we're set for a runoff on December 14th between incumbent mayor and former state legislator Sylvester Turner. He won 46% of the vote. Mm-hmm. Newcomer Tony Busby came in second, so he will join Mayor Turner in the runoff. Busby had 29% of the vote. He's a new time candidate, a very, very successful trial lawyer. He put in $10 million of his own money.
Wow.
Turner has effectively linked Busby, in my opinion, to President Trump. And President Trump is not popular among City of Houston voters.
There were a lot of candidates who were fighting Turner in this election. A huge slate. Still, 29% for Busby there, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's relatively a lot given the large field of candidates, it does seem. When is that runoff going to be?
December 14th.
What else stood out to you from election night 2019?
Well, Texas House District 28 certainly had a lot of attention on it, both statewide and nationally. Mm-hmm. That very solidly Republican seat is now headed for a runoff between Democrat Eliz Markowitz, who won 39%, and Republican Gary Gates with 28%.
So a Democratic candidate finishing first in a district that has been held by a Republican in the past. And we were talking a little bit about the fact that election results were kind of slow to come in, perhaps a scary harbinger for 2020. What do you think, Professor?
Yes, between new voting machines in some counties and different procedures for countywide locations, it was a very, very late night or very early morning.
We'll have more over at texasstandard.org. Renee Cross is Senior Director of the Hobby School of Public Affairs at the University of Houston. Dr. Cross, thanks again.
Thank you, David.
A couple of other races to mention. In Texas, House District 100, the seat vacated by new Dallas Mayor Eric Johnson, is an all-Democrat race. Lorraine Birabil and James Armstrong headed to a runoff. And in House District 148 in the Houston area, a seat once held by Jessica Farrar, looks like a runoff between Democrat Anna Eastman and Republican Luis Lorada. Some of the counts could get challenged, of course. We'll have the latest at texasstandard.org. All right, let's shift gears and dig into two new University of Texas Texas Tribune polls released today on two highly partisan subjects, immigration and climate change. This is part of a series of polls of registered voters in Texas conducted in the last few weeks. Here to tease out some of the details for us, James Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at UT. Welcome back to The Standard, James.
Good to be back.
So let's start with immigration. I'm guessing Democrats and Republicans divided on this issue.
A little different, David. Yeah. You know, this is immigration. I think you and I have talked about this before. It's one of the most fixed, steady aspects of the polling we've done over the last 7 or 8 years. So, you know, we ask questions about different aspects of policy. We cut it up different ways. We get basically the same thing, which is Democrats highly tolerant of legal immigration in particular, to a lesser degree, illegal immigration, and Republicans much more concerned about the impact of both illegal and legal immigration and find the issue very salient. So, you know, in our most important problem, battery, every poll, 50 to 60% of Republicans say the most important problem facing the state is either immigration or border security.
That is remarkable. That is remarkable. So as you think about 2020 and how this could play, how do you see immigration as a factor? What do these numbers tell you?
You know, it tells me that the way in which Donald Trump used the immigration issue to activate attitudes that were already there among Republicans and had been there for a while are still available for him to activate again in 2020, should he so choose.
Here's another one of those hot-button subjects that seems to divide Democrats and Republicans. New numbers on climate change. I guess a baseline here is, do you believe it's happening, right? And what do you find in these numbers?
You know, we started with exactly that very basic question, which can be deceptively complex to ask. So we just asked, do you think it's happening? Do you think climate change is happening? Not, do you believe science? Do you believe the reports? Do you believe, you know, just is climate change happening? Overall, 66% of Texans said yes, 23% no, 12% said they didn't know, you know, jury was still out. But as you imply, there are tons of partisan difference in there. 88% of Democrats say yes. Republicans are very evenly divided, so different than immigration, mm-hmm. where they're almost mirror images.
Right.
Republicans are divided. 44 say yes, 42 say no, 14% say they don't know.
Now,
that's a different kind of situation.
This seems to reaffirm something that is happening apparently nationwide. There are a lot more conservatives who are willing to acknowledge what they're seeing, how they're processing events in the news regarding, say, climate, and attributing it to the effects of climate change, it would sound like. But then there are the questions about policy. And is there a difference there?
Yeah, there's definitely a difference there. So another question in this battery we asked said, you know, what should the government do? Is the government doing, you know, should the government do a great deal or a lot, a moderate amount, or little or nothing about climate change? And, you know, in this, you see that division again. Democrats, 54% say government should be doing a great deal about this. Only 11% of Republicans say that. So the division among Republicans is actually more lopsided. And this should not be surprising given what we know about the general ideological kind of frame for Republicans, is they may very well think that climate change is happening. They might even be somewhat worried about it, but they're reticent to think that government is the route for action.
James Henson is head of the Texas Politics Project at UT Austin. We'll have links to more of this research over at texasstandard.org. Jim, good to see you again. Thank you so much for stopping in.
My pleasure.
Let's find out what Texans are talking about on this Wednesday, and I know just the person to do that. It's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hello there. Hi, David. Hello. We're hearing from plenty of folks about the election last night, specifically lots of people chiming in about Proposition 4. That was the Texas constitutional amendment there that would enshrine a ban on a personal income tax in the state constitution.
Not exactly a ban, but it is a very high bar to overcome if you want to change.
And of course, so many people chiming in about this. Interesting stuff here. Via Facebook, David Blom says he's always happy not to pay state income tax, but lots of people left with lots of questions, I guess you could say, David. Jason Deckman says, everyone happy that they defended the poor taxpayers from a state income tax that nobody was proposing? Meanwhile, Pat Houlihan, also via Facebook, says, something was fishy about that one. I'm curious to see what the smoke and mirrors were about. And Rachel Anthony, she goes one step further. She speculates that it was about franchise business owners now being individuals and setting up a challenge to the franchise tax. How this works, David, the franchise tax is essentially a state business tax.
Right.
And as Panika MC Dillon points out on our Facebook page, Prop 4 could make it hard to pass an income tax, or rather, she says Prop 4 doesn't do much to make it impossible to pass an income tax, but it changes a reference from natural persons to individuals. And that could set up a challenge to the franchise tax because, sorry to get into the weeds here.
No, I understand where that's going.
But a business is defined as an individual, so this change from natural person to individual, so lots of people are saying this could potentially set up a challenge to that state business tax.
I think I would want to read into that just a wee bit more.
Lots of people talking about this one, lots of speculation, and lots more talk about the election results. I'll be back with more on the election later in the show.
So what's got your attention, Texas? Tweet us, won't you, at Texas Standard, or look for us on your favorite social media platform. Wells Dunbar's looking for you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. A preventative regimen, including a healthy diet and exercise, can help prevent lung cancer. More at TexasOncology.com.
Business and your money on the Standard. I'm David Brown. You may have heard about the dating app called Bumble, the one that touts itself as a female-friendly dating app. Well, Bumble, a company launched by a female entrepreneur from Austin, is now partnering with Just, an Austin nonprofit that's issuing small loans to women who want to jumpstart their own businesses. The loans are issued on the basis of trust, not credit scores, and therefore, well, under $1,000. Some might recognize this as similar to microlending. Microlending is a movement that started in the 70s with a loan to a Bangladeshi woman who was living in poverty, but she used the loan to make and sell bamboo furniture to feed her family. Well, since then, many banks and non-bank entities now offer similar small loans, and repayment rates are extremely high, helping to dispel myths about loans to poorer communities. Well, the Bumble Just loans are an experiment with a special focus on low-income communities. You'll find it if you Google the 750 Fund. That's 750.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, whose workers' comp dividend program recognizes employers for striving to prevent accidents and helping to keep employees safe and on the job. More at WorkSafeTexas.com.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. $50,000. That is the fine the state of Texas will have to pay each day, starting this Friday, after a ruling Tuesday by U.S. District Judge Janice Graham Jack. This, nearly 4 years after that same judge ruled that Texas violated foster children's civil rights. In that time, Judge Jack has issued orders to address the issues she deemed unconstitutional, but yesterday she said, "I can no longer find DFPS credible," DFPS referring to the Department of Family and Protective Services. Quoting here, "They've lied to me at almost every level, and this is just shameful." Okay, how so and what happens now? For that, we are joined by Bob Garrett. He has been covering this story for the Dallas Morning News. Bob, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks for having me, David.
Judge Graham Jack sounds rather ticked off, I think, is the phrase. For our listeners, let's go back to the ruling from the judge back in 2015 that found the state's foster care system unconstitutional. She feels like the state's been dragging its feet, right?
Oh, yes. She said even then that for 20 years there had been blue ribbon studies saying the foster care system of Texas was a shame, something that had to be fixed, and nobody fixed it. And here, 4 or 5 years later, she's even madder about that inaction.
Jack issued orders outlining how DFPS could fix what she saw as problems, but the state of Texas appealed, claiming she was, overreaching. About half of Jack's remedies were upheld by the Fifth Circuit. What were those orders, and why is it that the state didn't respond?
Well, one of the biggest ones is about the caseloads of CPS workers who oversee these foster children. The Fifth Circuit said they could not have a hard caseload cap as Judge Jack wanted, but that they could have guidelines, and they upheld her remedy for having workload studies to see what it takes for to have a reasonable amount of time to do a good job. And those have not been done, and the state offered someone who doesn't really believe that limiting caseloads is correlated scientifically with better child outcomes. So Judge Jack was furious over that. But she was really, really upset, David, about lack of 24-hour awake supervision. Now, that's a buzzword, but what it basically means is that if you have six or more kids in a home or any kind of facility, you have to have an adult who's awake at night. And she has been trying to get this for 4 years and feels that the state misled her at trial, possibly even perjured themselves over the fact that some of these places, many of them do have adults at night, but some do not. And that is where Judge Jack feels these children are most vulnerable, when other kids they aren't related to who've been sexually victimized come in and become sexually aggressive or in other ways abuse kids.
So yesterday, Judge Graham Jack found the state in contempt of court for failing to comply with some of her earlier orders. And this fine, $50,000 a day, commencing Friday, correct?
That's right. 7 business days later, if her monitors aren't assured and that all the group settings have this 24-hour awake supervision, it doubles to $100,000 a day and will continue indefinitely until her eyes and ears, her court-appointed monitors, say, "Judge Jack, there's adults awake at night in all these places."
Well, so let's talk about what this means for Texas, because this sounds like it could get rather expensive rather quickly.
That's right. It could. And it's only one of the things that's going to get more expensive. We have 8 to 10 years worth of plaintiff attorney's fees that is still being haggled before Judge Jack, but could be $10 to $20 million there. And then she warned them, the state, yesterday that, "I don't trust you for anything." So the monitors now are going to be much more expensive. They're going to have to hire more people because I don't trust anything the state tells me. So we're talking a lot of money here down the road.
Is Texas ever going to pay that money? I mean, you think about how much money the state has already spent fighting this case. And now we have this contempt order, and this seems awfully personal.
It's very personal for Judge Jack. I think even as a private attorney in Corpus Christi, she had dealings with Child Protective Services and some family law cases, saw some of the agonies of some of these children that are so vulnerable. I think she carried that experience to the bench, and the state of Texas fought her tooth and nail more than any other state has fought these lawsuits. So I think we'll see whether the state continues to sort of act as if they can ignore her or whether they now start really saluting everything she says.
Well, can the state just say, no, we're not going to pay the fines?
I don't think so. I think that they can maybe appeal some of her findings, but I think she's on fairly safe ground because the Fifth Circuit has upheld the order she had on awake supervision at night more than once. And she pointed that out yesterday. And I think she feels that she can drive this hard. And she's making a point, a larger point, that it's time to work with me, or we're just going to have a really fractious and expensive process going forward.
Bob, I hate that we've waited until this point in our conversation, but I think it needs to be underscored so that we don't get lost in the process. You have reported, you have covered some stories that are truly enough to make people weep. The treatment of some of these foster kids, kids that are supposedly wards of the state, in unbelievable situations, and the suffering and the deaths. Could you give us a sense of just how serious the situation is here in Texas for kids in the foster care system?
Well, I don't want to suggest that every child has a miserable experience, because there are some very committed foster parents out there.
Indeed.
But the ones that we're talking about 11,000 kids that no one wants. They're not cute, cuddly kids for adoption. Their problems escalate the longer they're in the system. They bounce from placement to placement. And when they exit the system, Judge Jack found on the evidence, they exit it in worse shape than they came into it. So it is a long-term societal cost and a tragedy, David.
Bob Garrett has been covering this story for some time. He's Austin Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News. We'll have his latest at TexasStandard.org. Bob, thanks so much.
Thank you, David.
He's done some real memorable reporting there. We are coming up on 29 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. You know what's next, right? Yes, they call it Texas Roundup. It's our look at what's making news across the Lone Star State. So don't you touch that dial. There's a whole lot more of the Texas Standard coming up. Stick around.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is conceding this morning death row inmate Bobby Moore will spend the rest of his life in prison instead of dying by lethal injection. The decision follows previous U.S. Supreme Court rulings that Moore is intellectually disabled and therefore ineligible for execution. Moore was sentenced to death for fatally shooting a Houston store clerk in 1980. The Hunt County Sheriff's Office has freed the man initially accused of opening fire at an off-campus college party in Northeast Texas. KETR's Mark Haslett reports.
Brandon Gonzalez of Greenville was arrested less than 2 days after the shooting at a party rental venue just west of the Greenville city limits. But after spending 8 nights in jail, Gonzalez was released yesterday. Hunt County Sheriff Randy Meeks said exonerating evidence caused his office to drop all charges against Gonzalez. No other arrests have been made in connection with the October 26 shooting that killed 2 Dallas area men. 6 others were wounded by gunfire, and 6 more were hurt trying to escape. The party was attended by many students from nearby Texas A&M University Commerce.
Mark Haslett reporting. Workers in 6th Southeast Texas counties have 1 day left to apply for unemployment aid due to Tropical Storm Imelda. Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner has more.
Those in Chambers, Harris, Jefferson, as well as Liberty, Montgomery, and Orange counties have until Thursday to apply for disaster unemployment assistance through the Texas Workforce Commission. San Jacinto County still has some time. Their deadline is December 2nd. People applying must specify it's because of damage due to Imelda. Those eligible include people who lost their jobs and self-employed individuals unable to work because of the storm. People who can't work because of an injury caused by Imelda can also apply. I'm Sasha Cordner in Houston.
Texas Democrats who'd backed former El Paso Congressman Beto O'Rourke for president are now endorsing former Housing Secretary Julian Castro. O'Rourke dropped out last week. Castro announced 9 new endorsements from Texas legislators Tuesday, including State Representative Joe Moody of El Paso. He says Castro is unique because he does not look at issues in silos.
He builds his approach in an intentionally intersectional way so that when we're talking about homelessness, we're talking about a myriad of issues that include criminal justice reform, that include substance use disorder, that include housing insecurity and economic instability. They include all of these things because these issues are not simple. They are complex.
The endorsements come as Castro seeks to keep his campaign afloat. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the Texas Medical Center's Dr. Tim Garson and Ryan Holywell, authors of Exposing the 20 Medical Myths, Why Everything You Know About Healthcare is Wrong and How to Make it Right. Available on Amazon.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard. For years, since the early days of the so-called fracking boom that revolutionized oil extraction, there have been reports of increased seismic activity around fracking sites. But the industry and some lawmakers and regulators in Texas have been slow to declare a causal connection between the two, citing a general lack of scientific data. The TexNet earthquake monitoring system has been gathering data since only 2017. But when did that seismic activity actually begin? Well, now a big leap forward into visualizing the past. Cliff Froelich, Senior Research Scientist Emeritus at the University of Texas Institute for Geophysics, joins us. Dr. Froelich, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Good to be here.
It seems like the significance of this study, which was published in the Journal of Geophysical Research, is that you're able to leverage existing data in ways previously not done. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. In West Texas, there is an array of 10 seismographs all in about a 5-kilometer area that were installed in 1990. And they were actually installed to study nuclear explosions in the South Pacific and in Korea and across the world. Anyway, when the TexNet network started finding lots of earthquakes with magnitudes down to about 1, I said, hey, we can probably exploit this very sensitive array to study the seismicity in West Texas. And that's what I and my colleagues here at UT and at Southern Methodist University did.
So if I understand this correctly, then the significance of this research longer term would be that you found a way to extract useful data so that we can say more about seismic activity of the past.
You got that exactly right. Yes, I used data that has been collected for 20 years or more, and I was able to get a nearly complete catalog of earthquakes down to magnitude 1 going back to the year 2000.
So does your research appear to confirm the suspicion among many researchers and laypeople alike that increased fracking activity is directly correlated with increased earthquakes?
Well, I think most people, if they were ranking what causes earthquakes, the wastewater disposal is more likely to cause earthquakes than fracking.
But I think of wastewater disposal as a byproduct of the fracking process, right?
Well, it's not just fracking. When you produce a barrel of oil, you usually produce something like, say, 10 barrels of dirty water. And so it's the production of oil, gas, or wastewater disposal, or fracking is known in some cases to produce earthquakes. Our study was really thorough about finding when the earthquakes were. But part of the puzzle is that in counties north of where the earthquakes occurred, there has been a lot more wastewater disposal and oil and gas production than where the earthquakes occurred. And they don't seem to have earthquakes in the counties to the north where they have more oil and petroleum operations going on.
So this doesn't necessarily confirm the existing theories. But what it does is it gives us an opportunity for, in the future, making more precise determinations about those theories.
You could say that. The thing is that the data being collected by TexNet now is showing, yes, there is some relationship between the oil and gas industry and these earthquakes. But the question of when it started is huge. If you have a theory or a model about what's happening, you would really like to know when it all began. And we've got those data now.
When did it begin, Doctor?
2009 was where the cluster that's... last year, there was more than 2,000 earthquakes in this cluster, and this all started in 2009 with just about 30 earthquakes.
And so you don't see that before 2009. Suddenly, there's a boom in 2009.
That's right. Before 2009, there's here an earthquake, there an earthquake, just random little earthquakes, but nothing nothing you'd call a cluster or a boom.
What's happening in 2009 that causes these clusters?
Well, that's a good question. Again, is that there is some more injection and going on in that area. But again, what's puzzling is that although there is that is happening near where the earthquakes occurred, farther to the north, where no earthquakes occurred, there's a lot more wastewater disposal and production than there is where the earthquakes occurred.
But you're not seeing that kind of seismic activity farther to the north where the wastewater injection is happening.
No. So what our study does is pin down the earthquake history, but the question of its exact relationship to either production or wastewater or whatever is for ongoing studies that are ongoing at the University of Texas Bureau of Economic Geology.
Getting closer, Cliff Froelich, Senior Research Scientist Emeritus at the University of Texas Institute for Geophysics. Dr. Froelich, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. You've heard of the brain drain, right? Something big universities are sometimes accused of contributing to because they lure away some of an area's brightest minds. But a program at the University of Texas at Austin recently shifted focus to boost rural and small city entrepreneurship, in some cases, actually encouraging students from smaller Texas towns to go back home and explore options there. Art Markman is the director of the IC Squared Institute. He's also a psychology professor at UT Austin. Art, thanks for stopping by the Texas Standard Studios. Good to see you, sir.
It's great to be here, David.
Hit me with this. IC Squared. What does that mean?
So the IC Squared Institute is a 42-year-old think tank here at the university that has focused on economic development. Initially, back in the 70s, IC Squared stood for the Institute for Constructive Capitalism.
Wow.
Then later they called it the Institute for Innovation, Creativity, and Capital. And now it's just IC Squared.
IC Squared, that's where it is. But a big part of what IC Squared has done is it's encouraged sort of the spirit of entrepreneurship, I suppose you could say, right?
Absolutely. Played a huge role in Austin, going from being a sleepy college town in the 1970s to being the Austin, Texas we know and love today. And more recently, we've shifted our focus a little bit away from urban areas, which get the bulk of the attention when you think about entrepreneurship, towards overlooked communities, rural areas, smaller cities, and things like that, because there are just a different set of challenges there.
Well, let's talk about that for just a moment. I was driving from, I guess it must have been Hill Country one evening up to Austin, and I saw a great big sign promoting one of the smaller towns on the outskirts of Austin. And it said, why live in Austin when you could live out in this our little town? Because of sort of promoting telecommuting as an alternative. Is that the sort of entrepreneurship that you're hoping to encourage? Or are we talking about something more sort of institutionalized in rural Texas?
You know, I think that some of it could be telecommuting, but I think a lot of it is trying to really create new businesses in those communities, often around the strengths of those communities. So are there ways, for example, in West Texas of doing a little bit more work on renewable energy so that as the tides shift related to oil prices, these communities might be a little bit more resilient. You know, in some of the agricultural communities, it might be creating technologies around agriculture that might boost what's going on in those regions.
So you encounter a student who comes from some part of rural Texas. They've seen the big city. They have all these opportunities, and they have, in many cases, people pitching them money to come and join the firm. Yeah. How do you convince them to put down roots back home and to start to build from scratch?
Well, this was actually the basis for this Home to Texas program that we piloted last summer in conjunction with the College of Undergraduate Studies here at UT. Mm-hmm. And we're blowing it out to a much larger group of students this coming summer. And the idea is take first and second year students who haven't figured out what they want to do for a living yet. And, you know, when they left home, they were kids. They were high school kids. They don't really know much about their communities.
So you trick them. That's what you do. Trick them.
Well, you allow them to see the community with adult eyes. And not only do they go home with an internship, but they actually research the community. So they interview business leaders and government leaders and civic leaders and faith leaders and education leaders and really get to see what is exciting in this community.
This is a fascinating thing that you're pointing to, because I can recall, and I bet you a lot of our listeners can recall having experiences in a big town, going back to a smaller setting and thinking, you know, if I had only stuck around, I would have been a big person in this community.
Well,
had I sat through and really tried to build something from ground zero.
That's right. And you know, when you live in a big town, you know, if you're lucky, you might bump into a city official every once in a while at an event. Mm-hmm. But in a small town, you know, the mayor lives up the street. You know, the city manager is probably going to be standing online behind you at the grocery store. Right, and so you have much more of an opportunity to engage with the people who actually make the town run, so that if you have an idea and really want to do something big, you have all the players in place to make that happen.
Very exciting and interesting initiative. Art Markman is the director of the IC Squared Institute at the University of Texas. He's also a psychology professor at that same institution. And if you recognize his voice, perhaps it's because he's one of the co-hosts of the popular podcast Two Guys on Your Head, produced at the studios of our home station KUT in Austin. Dr. Markman, good to see you, sir. Thank you so much for stopping in.
Oh, thanks. Great to talk to you as always.
Last weekend, across a large part of West Texas, many of our listeners might have heard a sharp whistle and possibly even the chugging of engines echoing in the desert air. Now, the sound of a train is not uncommon in West Texas, of course, but this wasn't your usual freight or passenger line passing through. This was the sound of history. The largest operational steam engine in the country, Union Pacific's Big Boy 4014. Marfa Public Radio's Carlos Morales has details.
As you might guess, the Big Boy locomotive is, well, pretty big. It weighs in at 1.2 million pounds. The matte black engine looks like it belongs to a train set you'd see beneath a Christmas tree. Steam billows into the air behind it.
Steam trains are such a sensory experience. I mean, it engages all of your senses.
Alan Irby made the roughly six-hour drive from Pflugerville to see Big Boy 4014 in person.
The sounds, the smells, of the smell of the steam. Just everything about it. It's just kind of old-fashioned and kind of romantic in a way, and it just kind of excites the little boy in me.
There were only 25 Big Boy steam locomotives ever built for Union Pacific back in 1941. Once dubbed revolutionary by industry folk, they hauled freight all across the mountain states in the mid-century. Union Pacific renovated this one to celebrate the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad. It's the largest operational steam engine in the country.
It's pretty cool to see something restored that, you know, they took the time to do it.
Janet Walker from Odessa is here with her family, and she says her husband's a bit of a train nut. He's got a model of this very engine at their home on a bookshelf. He's busy right now, taking as many photos of Big Boy as possible before the renovated locomotive takes off for the next stop.
It's cool that they've done this and let, you know, people come out and take a look at it.
And there are a lot of spectators here early on this chilly November morning. There are cars lining up on both sides of the road, people standing in the beds of their trucks to get a better view. And some, like Walker and her family, are going to keep up with the train as it heads to its next few stops.
No, it's just kind of a cool thing to do on the weekend. Come out with the family, take a look at it.
As it chugs its way across the Southwest, this Big Boy is running on a different kind of fuel than it did in the 40s and 50s. it was converted to burn oil instead of coal. After sitting idle overnight, Big Boy is now getting ready to take off.
There it goes.
Margot Jones is here from Colorado, visiting her family in Alpine.
Oh, see the bell in the front? Dinging?
She's holding up her phone to try and capture the locomotive before it sets off for the next leg of its journey. For her, especially with this backdrop of the Chihuahuan Desert, this moment is a window into a time and place long gone.
It's like old west, old wild west. Right?
Big Boy 4014 will continue on to San Antonio, Houston, and then to Arkansas and Oklahoma before its final stop in Wyoming, where the Big Boy locomotives first made their name. I'm Carlos Morales in Alpine.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Congressman Louie Gohmert, the Republican from Tyler, says that the Inspector General for the Intelligence Community changed the rules regulating whistleblowers so that, quote, damage could be done to President Trump. Is that a fact? Joining us now is Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so what exactly is this claim by Congressman Louie Gohmert, and where did it come up?
So the congressman made this claim in an op-ed that he wrote in the conservative Daily Caller. He was talking about the whistleblower complaint that has prompted this ongoing impeachment inquiry into President Trump.
The Ukraine situation, right?
Right, exactly. And he calls the whistleblower a fake whistleblower, and he says, exactly as you did, that the Inspector General changed the rules for submitting whistleblower complaints to allow this specific complaint to go through because it wouldn't have met previous thresholds for complaints. And not only that, but that the Inspector General backdated this change.
Just to be clear, I wasn't saying that. I was quoting him.
Fair enough.
I did say. Okay, so is it true what he says about backdating the rules?
So we need to take a step back before we get into that. His claim stems from ones that we've seen before from others, supporters of President Trump and President Trump himself. They've said that these rules were changed to allow this complaint to move forward when otherwise it would not have been accepted.
Right.
And the short of it is that no rules regarding whistleblower complaints were changed whatsoever.
None at all.
None at all. So the current rules that dictate this process have been in place since 2014, and with the exception of a really small amendment in 2016, they have not changed whatsoever. They're the same.
Well, okay, so that sounds like we're done here. Right?
not quite. Okay. There is something to this statement in that while the rules were not changed, right, the form that is required to submit a whistleblower complaint, that was changed. Language on this claim was changed. And what's at issue here is whether a whistleblower submitting a complaint needs first-hand information in order to submit a complaint, or whether they can submit it with secondhand information. You know, they've heard from somebody that this thing is going on they need to report it.
Hearsay?
Sure. That's, yes.
That would be the legal terminology,
that would.
It sounds like. Okay.
So the original complaint form that you would fill out said that firsthand information is required, and it says the Office of Inspector General must have this information firsthand in order to find a complaint credible. But the issue here is that this language refers just to the investigation following the submission of a complaint and not to the requirements of the complaint itself.
Oh, okay. So just the submission as opposed to the substance of the complaint.
Right. So the complaint itself can have firsthand, secondhand, both levels of information. But in order for the Inspector General to move forward and find a complaint credible, they have to obtain firsthand information through their own investigation.
Understood. All right.
So after, in August, after this complaint was submitted, the Inspector General's office decided to change the form because they realize that this language might be a little bit confusing and leave the wrong impression that complainants have to have firsthand information.
I see. And that is not the case. You don't have to have firsthand information to file a complaint.
Right.
It's just whether or not it's going to succeed.
Exactly. Okay. And for what it's worth, the whistleblower complaint that we're talking about had both firsthand, secondhand information included.
All right. So, are we ready for a ruling now?
I think so. Are you ready?
I think so, but it seems like it's hard to get over the initial point, and that is that there does not seem to have been a rule change, as you were saying, since 2014.
Right. And Gohmert's talking about backdating a rule change, and you know, that doesn't even really make sense to explore because no rules were changed
hasn't
in the first
happened.
Place. Right.
All right. So what is the ruling from PolitiFact Texas?
We rated this claim pants on fire.
Pants on fire, Representative Louis Gohmert's claim that the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community changed the regulations on whistleblowers so that, quote, damage could be done to President Trump. Madeline Meckelberg is with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American-Statesman. Madeline, good to see you again. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Say, Wells Dunbar.
Say, David Brown.
Texas Standard. What are you hearing out there on the social media platforms?
Well, believe it or not, we're continuing to hear about Election Day results. Primarily, yes, in that constitutional amendment election, those 10 amendments that were up on the ballot. Johnny Billet, via our Facebook page, he chimes in with a theme we noted yesterday, how altered and amended the state constitution really is. Johnny says, some of these amendments are really just reminders of how awful the Texas Constitution is. How dysfunctional is a document when you need an amendment to adopt out dogs to their handlers, referring there, of course, to Proposition 10, which I believe passed with well over 90%, something on that order. This is the one that would have allowed service dogs for first responders, et cetera, to basically go home with their owners.
Why we do that? It's in our Constitution, similar to Alabama's, by the way, which we were talking about yesterday.
Number one, biggest
constitution. In order for the government in Texas to do anything, it has to have the express powers delegated to it by the people.
Right.
So that's the theory, as opposed to sort of this state sort of saying,
other states have basically they've done Constitution 2.0, where it's like they basically circumvent that. But Texas is, you know, we've been in it to win it, so to speak.
I guess so.
You know, and speaking of that dog issue, Prop 10, Pat Houlihan, Pat writes, I want to know who is so mad at the world that they voted against Proposition 10. Good question.
That is a good question. Yeah.
Jerry Harp chimes in on another one. Jerry says he's surprised that Proposition 1 failed. It's pretty unusual for an amendment to get voted down. I believe that was the sole amendment to get voted down, and it would have allowed those elected municipal judges to serve in more than one jurisdiction.
I think some people were confused. They didn't understand that some judges are already serving
like traveling judges and whatnot.
Jurisdictions.
Yeah, and that's the issue. You hear that a whole lot with the way the wording goes on these sorts of things, because you're trying to cram in all, you know, you see the bills or the, you know, financial notices, and it's page after page, and you got to cram that in to one screen there. Yep. Proposition 4, we talked about that earlier, prohibiting a state income tax, continuing to get reaction to that via Twitter. Cornell Wooldridge writes, those that voted for Prop 4 bought into the anti-tax rhetoric and failed to plan for Texas when oil and gas money may have dried up and more revenue will need to come from taxes. Hmm. Without income tax, property taxes are the only choice, killing the housing market and leading to a steady exodus. Not smart. And it does raise an interesting question. We hear so much from homeowners and people, you know, renters of people affected by property taxes, how dependent the state is on those property taxes. So it's kind of a case of the devil you know versus the one you don't there. Also, people chiming in about the vote in Houston. Lots of buzz long rambling speech from mayoral challenger Tony Busby. Seeing a little less reaction out there to another bit of runoff news. Brad Scarface Jordan, former member of Houston's pioneering rap group, the Ghetto Boys, making it to the runoff in his bid for Houston City Council Place D. So keeping an eye on that one. And of course, outside of Texas, several people on our Facebook page chiming in about the results of elections there in Kentucky and Virginia and what the Democratic showings there could mean for 2020.
Yeah. Seeing some breaking news here.
Yeah,
I don't know if you see this. House Intelligence Committee has announced that it will hold the first public hearings in the impeachment inquiry next week.
Woohoo!
Got a hunch that NPR is going to be talking about
this. That's going to be a hot one, for sure.
All day long. We're out of time for the big broadcast, but the news continues at TexasStandard.org. And, of course, we'll be back here tomorrow. I believe Laura Rice will be sitting in this very chair. In my stead. On behalf of the entire Texas Standard crew, I'm David Brown, wishing you a wonderful Wednesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.
PRI, Public Radio International.